Now, there's not many people who won't have heard of the great Stephen Hawking, but how much do you know actually about the man and his life and his achievements? You may have seen the film The Theory of Everything, but how close is that to the real Stephen Hawking? There's a new book out called Hawking, and its author joins us now, Joel Levy. Good morning, Joel. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with that. I mean, what about that film? Was it accurate, given what you've now written in the book?
Yeah, I mean, the film itself, well, for starters, it focuses on quite a small part of his life.
Yeah.
And it's quite instructive, actually, you know, writing a book about it and then looking at the film, because you can see what they've done in terms of, there's a lot of compression, there's a lot of sort of things put together.
Yeah.
For instance, he was at two different universities for his undergraduate and his postgraduate. So, but they've just sort of put them together, if you see.
Right.
And also, and above all, what the film focuses on, though, is his personal life. It was quite telling that his wife apparently commented after she saw the movie, she felt it needed more emotion and less science. And he said the exact opposite. And I have to say, I would come down on his side of that, because if you watch the movies, I mean, there's some gestures towards the science, but I guess it depends what your interest in Hawking is, if it's, you know, as a person in his life, or in him as a scientist in his science.
Yeah, I guess it's inevitable, isn't it, with those kind of films? There's the one at the moment with Freddie Mercury, which is completely inaccurate, but it's a blooming good film, and and you kind of, it's what you want to get out of it, I suppose, at the end of the day, isn't it? So let's talk about the man. He was born into a family of thinkers, really, wasn't he? I mean, his mother was Scottish, and she was quite a lady.
She was very smart. I mean, his dad also was quite a noted medical professor. Did a lot of research on tropical diseases. Was often away. They were quite an eccentric family. Mm. There's all sorts of amusing anecdotes about his childhood. They drove around in an old London taxi. And his father didn't really believe in central heating or insulation. They had a big old rickety old house in St Albans. They used to insulate it by piling up books against the walls.
Good grief. Fantastic. And I'm fascinated, having been a bit of a kind of school geek, that Hawking really wasn't a school geek as such. He wasn't really recognised as magnificently bright while he was at early school.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, that's not entirely accurate. He was recognised as bright, but
yeah,
he didn't necessarily excel.
No, but the one I'm getting at there is when you think back to school when you were young, and there are people in your class, you look at them and you think, do you know what? They're going to become some famous scientist or astronaut, or, you know, invent a cure for cancer, or they've just got that kind of thing about them. And I get the impression reading your book that wasn't really him.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, he's one of his nicknames at school was the Lazy Einstein, and I think that rather that encapsulates it, because everyone could see that he was fiercely intelligent, but he was lazy. And it's very interesting. It's very he's actually similar to some other famous scientific geniuses. Einstein and Newton, for instance, both did not excel at school, at least not until they put their minds to it.
Yeah. You know? So he kind of cruised through it because it was easy for him, basically.
Exactly.
How
I think that's right. And he wasn't that interested, maybe, in a lot of what was being taught. But, I mean, this is true of a lot of geniuses, basically. They tend to be self-taught.
Yeah.
They just sort of read into what's interesting to them. And they don't necessarily flourish until a bit later.
So he went to University College at Oxford at the age of 17, and he expressed a desire there to study maths. But of course, as we now know, Oxford didn't have a degree in that speciality, which are absolutely extraordinary. So he went into cosmology.
He went into cosmology a bit later when he wanted to decide what he wanted to do for his postgraduate.
Yeah.
I mean, His time at Oxford was, again, I think he was quite lazy. He famously couldn't be bothered to go to lectures, and he reckons he did about an hour of work a day or something.
Really?
Like that when he was there. It didn't stop him from cruising through it. But, I mean, he was more interested in, he was having fun, and he was part of the rowing team. So this is obviously before his illness struck him down, if you see what I mean. But again, it's the lazy Einstein thing. It was maybe easy for him. He didn't make that much effort.
Mm. So the illness, obviously, is the thing that partially defined him as it went on. So tell us about that diagnosis and what the actual disease was, because it wasn't an obvious one, was it? So tell us a little bit about that.
No. It's called amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, which is more commonly known in America as Lou Gehrig's disease after a famous baseball player who came down with it. And it's a degenerative neuromuscular disease. Basically, the nerves that serve your muscles, that lead from your brain to your muscles, those nerves start to degenerate, which means that you can't control the muscles. And when the muscles then are not being activated by nerves, they then waste away. Mm. And so you lose, obviously, the ability to move. This is your sort of voluntary muscles. So it doesn't affect your sort of digestion, but ultimately what it will, in a lot of people who get it, it will affect their breathing. And eventually they lose the ability to work their diaphragm, their lung muscles. Mm. And so they, you know, they would eventually suffocate. But the thing is, it's different in everybody. And what was fascinating about his particular disease was, although it came on quite suddenly and then got worse very quickly, so that initially the doctors told him he had about 2 years to live.
Yeah.
Although it got very severe, it kind of then stopped or it spared certain vital aspects. So he was able to keep breathing, for instance, and because he also had very excellent medical care for his whole life, he survived to a ripe old age, and he completely defeated all the doctor's predictions. But as you can imagine, it was a bit of a shock to him, because initially, the best knowledge that they had was that he only had, maybe 2 years to live.
And would it be fair to say that kind of jolted him into action? I mean, he'd been bored with life up until that point, and with this kind of sudden realization that he might not even live long enough to earn his PhD, was that the point which kind of triggered him?
Well, it didn't quite happen like that. Actually, I mean, quite understandably, it plunged him into despair, as I think it would for most of us. And he supposedly retreated to his room and listened to a lot of Wagner and drank a bit of red wine. Rather romantically, he later said it was love that saved his life and that motivated him. Because it was when he fell in love with Jane that he realized that he had something to live for. And that was when he got a bit more serious about his career, if you like.
Mm. Of course, his health was a constant concern all the way through his life. And we, of course, know the kind of the picture of him because of that voice. What's the story of that voice that he was given at some point?
Yeah, so his vocal cords were affected, and his speech started to degenerate quite early. And so for a long time, he relied on people like his wife and his graduate students who could understand what he was saying, because most other people couldn't. But eventually, one of the main health risks to him was that he would get lung infections, because he couldn't control if things went down the right passage into his lungs instead of his stomach. And so he was in constant sort of danger of pneumonia. And this is all dramatized in the film, that on one occasion when he was in Geneva visiting a nuclear research institute, and his wife was coming overland by car to meet him, she suddenly got this panic phone call that he'd been rushed into hospital, and in order to save his life, basically, they'd had to cut open his windpipe and sort of intubate him, basically, which meant that he would never be able to speak again because they had to do that to save his life. And so that was really when... But to be honest, by that time, his speech had been pretty much unintelligible anyway. But then that proved the stimulus for a man in California sent him a computer program, basically. There was a sort of voice synthesizer. You could choose words from a menu, and then it would synthesize his voice. And because this was back in the 80s, it was pretty basic sort of level of voice synthesis.
Yes.
And hence the sort of robotic quality. And one of the interesting things, there's a lot of debate about what exact accent you would describe that synthetic voice as. I mean, because most people think, and I don't know what you think of it, he himself, I mean, was it American? Was it Scandinavian? Nobody can really put their finger on it. Anyway, I mean, later on, it would have been possible for him to have a more developed voice, if you like, more advanced or sophisticated voice, maybe with more inflections.
Yes.
But by that time, he felt, as I guess a lot of people, in the wider world felt, that the voice was identified with him, and that was
how interesting.
Voice, if you like. And so he chose not to change it.
Oh, that's interesting. I was going to ask you that, why he didn't take advantage of the clear technology advances in that area, just because he thought that was just his defining voice then.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, I guess it becomes part of your own self-image as well as everyone else. Yeah. I mean, I think it maybe also speaks to the way that he wanted to present himself or thought of himself. You know, the voice famously, it was quite flat, didn't have a lot of affect, didn't have a lot of inflection. So and that meant it was measured and it was kind of rational and it wasn't a great deal of emotion in it. And so maybe that tells us something about the way he thought about himself and wanted to present himself.
You mentioned Jane. That was a young language undergraduate that he met. Jane Wilde, anyone who's seen the film kind of knows the love story part of it. Who knows what Stephen Hawking would have been had Jane not come into his life?
Well, indeed, yeah. I mean, he said himself that she gave him something to live for. And so, I mean, obviously that love story aspect is what the filmmaker seized upon and made it the focus of their film.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, they had children as well. But later on, Hawking left Jane for one of his nurses, wasn't it?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, obviously their relationship was very complex. It's very hard for anyone to imagine the stresses and strains of which her life consisted, because she had to do so many roles. She was a mother and a homemaker, but she also had to be a sort of full-time carer, and she also had to be a sort of PA and managing his schedule, and he traveled an enormous amount, and obviously everything was incredibly complicated because of his condition and all the stuff that came with it. And she also felt that she had to pursue her own academic career because she didn't want to become, she felt the way that society worked in Cambridge, that you had to, you know, have your own academic chops if you wanted to be taken seriously.
Yeah.
So she was under constant strain, and as dramatized in the film, you know, their relationship had changed a lot, and she'd met this man who came into their lives, and it was platonic, but, you know, it was obviously quite intimate at the same time. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot more complicated than to just say that he left her. But obviously, you know, things developed. He had this nurse, and then that all became a very contentious story in itself, because later on she was accused of physically abusing him, although police were called, although he never pressed charges, and the whole thing, it was all a bit murky and strange and was never really sorted out, and he did in fact later divorce. But obviously, you know, he and his wife had a very complicated relationship, and it's very hard for us to imagine how difficult her life must have been, I guess.
Absolutely. Let's talk about the man's brain, because that was the size of the universe. I don't know about you, I did science A-levels, and I had an attempt at a brief history of time, having a read through it, and that was supposed to bring cosmology to the masses. That was it dumbed down, but my goodness me.
Yeah, it's famously said to be the most popular, least read book ever. Although people always said this to Hawking, and he used to point out that the same could be said of the Bible and the works of Shakespeare, so he was in good company. The focus of my biography of him is his science, because I don't think his personal life is of such interest, personally. I mean, I don't think it's what makes him special. Mm-hmm. I think it's his science that makes him special. I mean, obviously, his personal story of triumph over a terrible disease is pretty extraordinary, but ultimately I think it's his science that's his real legacy, and so that's what I focused on in my biography.
Sure. He was almost a rock star scientist, wasn't he, if there is such a thing?
He was indeed, yeah, and he used to fill massive lecture halls, and he would tour the world, and he did, and of course he did, you know, and he hung out with rock stars, you know, with Bono or whatever, and then he got to do some cool things like going weightlessness and stuff. And some of that was pretty amazing, because it showed he was defying the limitations of his disability, and so it's very inspiring. But there was quite a lot of resentment in the scientific world, because people felt that he was trading on his fame, and it wasn't to do with his academic achievements.
Yes.
And there is a case to be made that his greatest academic achievements came in the sort of 70s and early 80s, and after that he was, you know, he didn't really make any major breakthroughs or contributions. And so it is, although he's generally said, oh, he was the greatest living scientist and blah, 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 actually in the physics world or the cosmology world, he's not regarded as being in the first rank necessarily, which might seem breathtaking to your listeners, but that's a reflection of, you know, when you actually look at his science. But having said, you know, but we shouldn't, it shouldn't obscure his greatest breakthrough. It's hard to explain very quickly, but he did work on black holes and the cosmology of black holes, which achieved something that no one else had done, which was to kind of reconcile some areas of physics that people have been trying to reconcile for a long time, which was sort of gravity and Einstein's work and quantum physics. And the great challenge in physics is to reconcile those two different sort of ways of looking at the world. And his black hole theory was the closest anyone's ever come.
That's really interesting you say that he wasn't kind of regarded as by his own peers as the kind of top of the tree. But, and I guess for members of the public, we think of people like Einstein and we go, oh, yes, Einstein's theory of relativity. We think of, you know, we think of Newton. We can talk about apples dropping out of trees. But with him, as you say, it's such a complex subject matter that he was having breakthroughs in. It's hard to actually even describe it.
It really is, absolutely. I mean, you know, his initial breakthrough, which they talk a lot about in the movie, that he got his PhD for, was about showing that the Big Bang probably started as a kind of black hole in reverse. And so that one's a bit easier to sort of grasp, if you like.
Yeah.
But his the work that he's scientifically most celebrated for was to do with black holes and whether or not they can evaporate, that kind of thing. And it's very hard to explain to a general audience. I mean, that's one of the main purposes of my book, is to explain it step by step, and hopefully I've made it clear. But there's no way to encapsulate it in a sentence. You
know? One of the interesting things that he talked about a lot, and even just before the end of his life, I remember him speaking at a conference in Lisbon, I think it was kind of November time, 2017, and he talks about AI, artificial intelligence, a lot, and about the possible dangers of AI. And they could be a good thing, but they could also be potentially very destructive for the human race.
Yeah, I mean, later in his life, he obviously became this sort of grand old man of science and one of those sort of wise talking heads of Western culture. So he would be wheeled out to proclaim on all sorts of subjects. And he can actually, there's quite a range of things you'll see in my book. There's quite a range of prophecies of doom that he became a bit of. I'm afraid he became a bit of a Cassandra. I mean, not to say he wasn't accurate. I mean, he's probably right. There probably are a lot of reasons to fear doom. AI was one of the ones, yes, he was one of the prominent figures warning of the dangers of that, absolutely.
Aliens, he talked about them a lot as well.
Yes, I think he was one of the people, I think he said that that maybe aliens wouldn't be so friendly if we met them, but he was also interested in the sort of efforts to reach out to them, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it'll never be forgotten. That's for absolute certainty. And I'm delighted that what you've done, as you say in the book there, is not go over the old ground of the personal bit of it, because that's pretty much covered in the movie. I thought it was worth doing again today just to kind of give people a picture of the man, but it's the science that he was involved in that the book is about. It's called Hawking. Joel Levy, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time, sir, and happy Christmas to you.
Thank you. Can I just say hello to my Auntie Jackie if she's listening in Spain? And thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me.
Fabulous, Joel. All the best to you, sir. Have a good one. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Okay.